What I want to do today is a little different. It's very different. I want to pick out one person to focus on for today, since it's Memorial Day. And that person is Bill Bomar, my father. Why are you picking your father? Because I'm the preacher and I can do that. I'm also picking him because he was a veteran. He served in the Air Force. We're sort of having a kind of a family reunion this weekend. Ruthie, my sister, is up, and Vinny's up, and all my boys are going to get together tomorrow and have a little family-type reunion. So that's another reason. We've got all them here. Another reason is my dad was very instrumental in the continuation line of this church. He preached here for between 6 and 7 years. At a time when the church was really struggling. So that's another reason to pick him. And the last reason is it was 30 years ago this weekend on Memorial Day that he passed away. So with all of those things going on, I wanted to take an opportunity to share with you about him. Some of you don't know him at all, don't know anything about him. Many of you do because you were here when he preached here. So my goal is to try to share with those of you who don't know anything about him a very remarkable man and somebody who changed the lives of so many people. And for those of you who already knew him, my goal is to fill in the gaps because you knew him here at Walnut Grove, but you didn't know a lot about him before that. So I'm going to spend some time and go through briefly his life and how he developed into the person that he was and how he changed lives and share with you what I believe is the secret to his success in life because he indeed was very successful. He was born in Nashville, Tennessee, 1921, and right off the bat, the home of country music, he was an avid country music fan. In our house, radio stations only had one preset. It didn't matter which button you pushed. They all went to the local country music station, and I couldn't stand country music. But Dad loved it, and I was always trying to sneak and change the station, and he'd come back and jump in the car or whatever, and he'd hear, you know, the music that I liked, and he'd say, "Turn that trash off," and he'd get it back to country music. And I said, "You know, Dad, you call my music trash." I said, "But look at country music." I said, "Think about what they're saying in all these songs." He said, "There's nothing wrong with what they say in country music songs." I said, "Well, if you play one of them backwards, you know, the guy gets his wife back, he gets his dog back, and he gets his pickup truck back." I said, "That's what country music is all about." Well, he didn't think that was very funny. But anyway, I had to grow up with country music. As a young boy in Nashville, Tennessee, he developed some indications of what his life was going to be like. He was quick to try to turn a profit. He was a young little businessman. My grandmother, his mother, told me that when he was somewhere between 3 and 4 years old, think about this now, she said he pulled his little wagon out of the house and he got a box of graham crackers and put them in the wagon and he was walking up and down the street trying to sell the graham crackers to people. The trouble was he couldn't say the word graham. It came out damn. So he was walking up and down the street screaming, "Damn crackers, damn crackers." She put an early end to his sales pitch. But he grew up with a unique athletic ability. He was very, very athletically talented. Something I wished he could have passed on to me. But it jumped right over my generation and went to my boys, who were also all very athletic. But my dad was especially good in any kind of sport, but especially baseball. He was just outstanding in baseball. Out of high school, he signed with the Chicago Cubs organization. And he started out in their farm system, and he quickly worked his way up to what they call AAA, which is the next level before the big leagues. And in my opinion, this is the son talking, I believe that he easily would have made it into the professional level and would have been a household name that you all would have heard had it not been for World War II. Because it was during his time in the AAA League that he was called to service for our country, and he went, and like I said, he went with the Air Force and served during his peak baseball years. I know that he would have been good because I have seen a trophy. I found it in a box of memorabilia a long time ago. He was given in AAA ball, and this is the early 1940s, 42, something like that, where he won the batting championship for all of the minor leagues. Now, today, if you're a baseball player and you can hit 300, you're paid a lot of money. That means 300 out of 1,000 times at bat, you get a hit. He had a trophy, and I saw it on there. He batted 500 for a whole year. Now, that's unheard of. I remember a few years ago, who was it that batted 400? Somebody did. I can't think of his name right now, but who? There you go. Thank you, Joe. My sports encyclopedia back there. But it was a big question. Would he make it to the end of the season, hitting 400? I think, what was his name? Long, way back when. Another guy. Thank you. Thank you. Had a chance to sit out the last game of the season and assure his 400 batting record, but he didn't. He went to bat and he did it anyway. So he still. But anyway, 400 was just unheard of. I think twice it's happened. He batted 500. But anyway, that's why I think he would have been outstanding. Plus, he played third base, which is a highly skilled position in baseball. But anyway, his career was cut short by the Army. When he got out of the Army, he then was able to go to college on the GI Bill, and he went to the University of Georgia, which. He's a diehard Georgia fan, right, Vinny? And while he was at Georgia, he was hired as the baseball coach. And as the coach, Tim, I don't even know if you know this or not, but he was a player coach, which means he could actually get in the lineup himself, which, if you've listened to what I've said already, that's illegal. He already played pro ball. But he he figured, I'm going to play college. Who's going to stop me? So he played college ball after playing pro ball, which was highly unusual, but was very successful at the University of Georgia. And it was at the University of Georgia he married Miss Marjorie Henderson, who's here visiting with us today, and spent the rest of his life with her. And they got married, and they moved, I believe, Mom, to Bainbridge, Georgia, shortly after they got out of college. He took on a job there. I believe he was not only the coach, but he was the principal of the high school, and he coached all three sports, and I believe he was a teacher there too, and he might have even been a janitor. I'm not sure. But it was a small school, and he was all-encompassed. But he was very successful in his coaching career there, so much so that he attracted the attention of a school in Florida called Dunellen High School. And Dunellen sought him out and brought him down and signed him up to be their principal, their athletic director, and their coach of all their major sports. Now, the thing about Dunellen High School was, when my dad went there, they didn't have a football team. They didn't have any uniforms. They didn't have any football field. They didn't have anything. They wanted to start a football program, so they thought, let's get this guy to start a football program. So he went in with absolutely no foundation at Dunellen High School, 1958. 3 years later, Dunellen High School won the state championship in football. 3 years. It was amazing what he was able to do in coaching. That was his gift. That was what God cut him out to be, was to be a coach. It was also in Dunellen that I met him for the first time. That's where I was born, in 1958. And I got to witness growing up the impact that he had on so many lives. After he left Dunellen, we moved to Inverness for, I think, a year, and then we moved to Bradenton, Florida, where he was again recruited to be a coach at Palmetto High School, where Mark Goodson played football for him. And at Palmetto High School, I remember specifically in the year 1968, Palmetto went through their entire season undefeated. It had never been done before. So he had this ability. He was just a winner. He just had the ability to bring the most out of his players, and I think Mark could testify to that too. And they just won. They won. They won. They won. They always were winning. He had a humorous side to him, and Mark told me this story. You'll remember this, Mark, as I tell it. He said, one day, they were at practice, I believe, and my dad had tires on his car that were well beyond tread. I mean, they looked like racing tires, you know, with no tread on them. And you could see the steel belts coming through. He just wore them till they absolutely had nothing left on them. But in Florida at the time, they had these inspections like we have here, and you can't pass an inspection without some tread on your tires. So he did not want to throw away his old tires until they absolutely exploded on him. So he was at practice one time. Mark's smiling. He knows where I'm going. One of the other football players pulled up in his nice new car with his nice new tires on his car, and my dad looked at his cars, and he looked at his tires, and he looked at his tires, and he looked at the size, and he looked at the size of his. And he said to the boy, do you remember the guy's name? I think your tires will fit on my car, won't they? And kid says, whatever you say, coach, you know. So he had him take the jack out of his car, jack up both cars, switch the tires, and then while they were having practice, he took his car down and got it inspected. Then he brought his car back and said, okay, you can switch your tires back. Your dad must be like that too, Jeff. That's the way he was. He tried to get everything he could out of every little thing. And I got a call this week from one of the players that played for him in Dunellen. His name was Bill Rowland. I've never met Billy before. He called me because he heard Vinny about the service. He said, I just want you to know, I can't make it up. He said, but I played for your dad. And he said, I want you to know that other than my father, his father, he said, nobody had as much impact on my life as your father did. He said, I am what I am today because of your dad. And that really touched me. And I know, Ruthie, you've probably heard people tell you that. And Vinny too, and I. A month doesn't go by. Now this is just 30 years later. A month doesn't go by. Usually a week doesn't go by that somebody doesn't still tell me that, the impact that he had on their lives. We went this last week. You know, when Bob preached for us, we went to the Ark Encounter, and I had two people on the bus come up and tell me. I didn't know. One of them I didn't know at all. The other one I knew of him, but I didn't really know him. And they both told me the impact that my dad had on their lives. One of them was specifically on him. The other one, he said, we'll never forget what your dad did for our son at school. Because the biggest impact that he had was on teenage boys, the boys that he coached. And that therein lies, I believe, the reason for the success of his life. It wasn't about the victories. The victories were nice, but he used, I believe, the victories and the coaching as a tool to reach hearts. And he was a master at that. He could reach the hearts of kids in that gift that God had given him of coaching. Now, he couldn't do hardly anything else. He was not what you would call mechanically minded. He had difficulty, you know, figuring out how to change a light bulb. It's that kind of difficulty. I remember one time, he had dented a bumper on the front of his car, and he was trying to take the dent out of the bumper. So he had one of these little handheld sledgehammers, you know, about that big. And he's sitting there hitting this thing, and he starts hitting it from underneath like this, trying to knock the – you see where this is going? He's trying to knock, and he's getting lower and lower, and he's trying to knock this dent out of this bumper. And I'm standing there watching him. And I said, Dad, I said, what you're doing is dangerous. I said, do you realize what would happen if you missed that bumper? I said, you're swinging, you know, right up. And he's sweating, and he's getting mad because this bumper's not coming out. And he said, I know what I'm doing. And the very next swing, he missed the bumper and hit himself right in the forehead with this little sledgehammer. And down he went. Just like when you make the snow angels. He was laying there on the ground. I shouldn't laugh at this. Blood coming out of his head. I didn't say a word. Didn't have to. But that's the way he was. He mechanically minded, he didn't think that way. And he didn't try to, really. He knew what his gift was, and he exercised that gift. After his stay at Palmetto High School, he decided that he had a master's degree in education. He wanted to get his doctor's degree. He wanted to be able to, you got more money if you had a doctor's degree. You want to be able to provide for his family. So he took a year off, went back to the University of Georgia as an adult, and we all had to be at home without him for a year. It was a tough time for us. But he did. He got his doctor's degree. He came back. And when he came back, the county had to take him back, but the slot at Palmetto had been filled, so they put him at Southeast High School, which is where I went to school, and Ruthie went to school. And so we had to go to the high school where our dad was the coach, and that's hard. And I had to play on the teams where my dad was the coach, and that's hard too. But I played 4 years of baseball for him, and had a very mediocre career. But I enjoyed watching him interact with the other kids on the team. I marveled at how he was able to reach into their soul and draw out good things from them. I also played the football that he coached there. It was on the freshman, ninth grade level. We had freshman teams back then. And he was undefeated just about every year that he coached. I played for him my freshman year. One thing that I remember about the freshman football days was, I think it was late 1972, there was another team in Florida by the name of the Miami Dolphins who made history that year. They're the only team to successfully win every game throughout the entire season and every playoff game and win the Super Bowl, 17-0, the perfect season. At the same year the Miami Dolphins had their perfect season, Bill Bomar had a perfect season with the Southeast High School freshman football team. They went 6-0. Well, he thought that was enough of a connection that he could call up Don Shula, the coach of the Miami Dolphins, and share their mutual thing they had in common. And he got him on the phone. And he talked to Don Shula, and he said, Don, Bill Bomar, we have something in common. Both our teams went undefeated. He said, I think that calls for celebration. I think we ought to get together, our two teams. And you know, he talked him into it. They got a bus, and they put his freshman football team and drove him down to Miami, Florida, while they're practicing for the actual playoffs, going to the Super Bowl. They let the Southeast High School freshman football team into a closed practice and meet and greet all of the football players. You remember Garo Yepremian, the field goal kicker? I got to stand in the end zone and catch his kicks during practice and throw them back to him. Now, for a Miami football fan, that was just like off the charts. I couldn't believe that was happening. Why did it happen? Because my dad had the ability, I don't know how he did it. Maybe the nerve is a better way to say it. Nobody was above him, and nobody was below him. He could talk to anybody, and use the expression, he could talk a squirrel off a nut wagon. He could talk anybody pretty much out of anything. And that wasn't just sports. Those of you who like country music, you may remember a guy by the name of Bill Anderson. My dad liked Bill Anderson. Bill Anderson was coming into town, so my dad called him out. Bill, I'm in town. You're in town. Why don't you come by the house? Bring your band. Bring your bus. We'll have a cookout on the back porch. Next thing you know, a Greyhound bus is coming down the road. Is that right, Ruthie? Pulls into our driveway. Out comes Bill Anderson and his bus. And we had a cookout. And then, of course, Dad's on that night at the concert. Dad's got tickets now. He's sitting on the front row. And Bill Anderson's down there waving to him and giving a thumbs up. He had the ability to do that. I don't know how he did it, but he did it. But here's something important about it. It wasn't just if you were an important person that he cared about you. He cared about what we would consider unimportant people too. I also remember riding in the car with him one time, and we witnessed an accident. And the two cars collided, and people are getting out of the car, and the lady who caused the accident getting out of the car, and she's walking around the front of her car, and she sees the damage, and she just breaks down crying. And she's wailing away. And she's saying, my husband's going to kill me. This is a brand new car. He just let me drive it. And I don't know who she's talking to, but she's shouting all this stuff out. He's going to kill me. And she's hysterical. And Dad walks up to her. He doesn't know her. He puts his arm around her. He says to her, that's nonsense. He said, your husband doesn't care about this car. He cares about you. And she looked at him, and she said, he does? And he said, yes. He's going to be worried. When he hears you're in an accident, he's going to be worried about you. He doesn't care about the car. She stopped crying. And she regained her composure. He got back in the car, and off we went. That's the way he was. He cared about people. He had an impact on so many people. Well, when my high school career was over, and I went to Mars Hill up here, came up to Mars Hill. At that time, my mom and dad drove me up here, and they kind of fell in love with the area too. And I just loved the mountains. First time I saw them, I just said, this is where I want to live. And after a couple years at Mars Hill, when I was going home for summer spring break stall, I said to Dad, I said, don't you like the mountains? He said, yeah, I like the mountains. I said, why don't you move up there? And he said, well, yeah, why not? So they retired. And they sold their house, and they moved up here. And they moved at first to Banner Out for a year up on Beach Mountain, and then right down the road here. And I got to see them, of course, more on my junior and senior year because I wouldn't have to go all the way to Florida to visit them, but I'd come right here. But while they were up here, several things happened. One thing that happened was Gladys got my dad involved in prison ministry. And he started preaching at the old prison on what's it called, Prison Camp Road. I went in there with him a couple times and was very impressed by it. And I should back up just a little bit before he left to come up here. Because of the influence he had on people, he was invited many times to speak at different dinners and motivational type of things, Rotary Club, sports banquets, things like that. He became pretty well known as a motivational speaker, and he did a really good job at it. He was able to reach businessmen who were there. He was able to reach parents of children was there because his message was always centered on Jesus. I don't care what the venue was. He found a way to work Jesus into his message. And he had a powerful impact on people. And I believe it was that public speaking venues that he made himself available to that eventually gave him the confidence to become pastor here at Walnut Grove. But it wasn't just to the important people that he preached to. I remember one time well, I'm sure this happened on multiple Christmases, but he would go, we had a home for mentally retarded adult people, and he would go there and play Santa Claus for them. I don't know if you remember that, Vinny, or not, but I got to go one time and watch him, and it was hilarious. He'd sit down on his chair, and these big 250, 300-pound men with a five-year-old mindset would sit on his lap and tell him what they wanted for Christmas. He was sitting there groaning, trying to hold him up. But he would pat him on the back, and he ministered to them. They had nothing to offer him at all. But that was his belief, that he had that duty to minister. And again, I think that carried over when he came up here. Also, after he spent a year or two at Lees McRae coaching there, and then he started his career at Avery High School. And by the way, Tim wrote a wonderful article, much more condensed than what I've been going through, but covered, hit all the topics that I'm talking about. And Tim, I want to thank you for the respect that you have shown my dad through the years. And I want you to know you were very dear to him, to his heart. So thank you for the article. And thank you, Vini, too, for Vini's kind of the person that got all this going and set all this up. She's the organizer in the family. I'm not. I fly by the seat of my pants. Just tell me where you want me in 10 minutes, and I'll be there. But Vini got in touch with Tim and got the articles that you may have seen in the paper and online and all, which reached all the way down into Florida. I've had people contact us about that and share their thoughts about Dad. So thank you, Vini, for doing that too. Anyway, he got here to Walnut Grove, and there he met Fred Stout, and he met Bill Wilkins, and he met Rock Hall, and others in Walnut Grove Church. And as Glenda told me earlier, I talked to Glenda this week about it. She said at the time my dad came here, this church was on its last legs. She said, I think she said they would have 10 or 15 people coming, and four of them was her family. It just was kind of really, really struggling. And between those men that I just mentioned and my dad, they took it upon themselves as a goal to bring this church back. And they did bring it back. When I went down to Florida to go to law school, I would still come up here and visit, and I saw this church busting out of the seams. All of these pews were filled. The loft was filled. The doors were open over there in the Sunday school room, and there was an overflow area there. Again, he had that ability to draw people out and to bring out the best in people. But it was all centered on Jesus. Glenda told me this touching story of her husband, TJ, who most of you knew TJ well. Some of you are new, wouldn't have known TJ. TJ was the music director at the time, and he was an elder in the church. She said one night she was going in to bed. TJ was already in bed. She said he was laying there smiling. She said, "What are you grinning about?" TJ said, "I just got saved." She says, "What do you mean you just got saved? You're an elder in the church. You're the song leader." He said, "I listened to what Coach Bomar said in the message. And he said, I realized that even though I'm a leader in the church, I never had a personal relationship with Jesus in my life." And he said, it convicted me. And he said, I was just laying in your bed thinking about that. And he said, I asked Jesus into my heart. He said, I got saved. Well, she was joyful about that. Well, the next week he wanted to come to church. And this would be kind of humbling, I would say, to get up in front of the church and announce to them that for the first time, I've been saved. But that's what he did. That's what TJ did. And bless his heart, if you knew TJ, you would have thought he was saved before. He was one of the nicest, kindest men I've ever met in my life. But that's not enough. You need to have an experience with Jesus Christ. The nicest men in the world without Jesus are going to hell. It's a sad thought, but it's going to happen. Well, that's just an example of how Dad was able to reach into people's hearts with Jesus, convict them, and bring them along. What was his secret, though? Why did so many people say that they were his best friend? Why did so many students in high schools give their life to Christ, give up smoking, give up wild partying type days? They did it because they didn't want to disappoint Coach Bomar. They changed their lives because of him. He had that kind of impact on him. What was the secret? If we knew the secret that Bill Bomar knew, we could have the same impact on the people in our world. I know the secret. I know what his secret was. Do you want to know what it is? Then you got to come back next week. Garrett says, don't you do that. No, I'm going to tell you the secret. I love doing that too. Just, here's the secret. When he looked at you, when he met you for the first time, he took a stamp out of his pocket, Bob, an invisible stamp that you couldn't see, and he stamped the word on your forehead, only he could see. And that word was valuable. And when he put that on your forehead, every time he looked at you, he saw somebody valuable. Think about this. If you have somebody you consider valuable in your life, let's just your favorite movie star, your favorite sports hero, whatever. If that person was here right now, you would look at that person and you say, that guy's valuable because of what I think about him. That's the way my dad thought about everybody he met. He stamped valuable on their forehead. And when he looked at you, that's what he saw. He said to himself, that person is valuable to Jesus. God created him, and he's of value to Jesus. And if he's of value to Jesus, he's of value to me. And my dad would treat people that way. Everybody he knew. That's why when you looked in his eyes, if you knew him, and you saw a sparkle in his eyes, it's because he was looking at you and seeing value in your life. And he was searching to draw out that value so that you could reach your full potential. He was born to be a coach. He was born to be a leader. And he did it, and he did it very well. You didn't have to be important for him to stamp valuable on your forehead. I know for a fact, because I've seen it, he was much closer friends. In all of his different high schools that he went to, he was much closer friends with the janitor than he was the principal. He had a lot of problems with principals. Had no problems with janitors. He was much closer to the ladies that served lunch in the cafeteria than he was the other teachers. Not saying that he treated teachers and principals bad. I'm just saying that it didn't matter what your status was. He stamped valuable on your forehead. If you knew him, you would know that. You would feel that. You would feel the value that he had for you. There is a Bible verse which I believe sums up his attitude, and that is Philippians 2:3. Says this: do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, consider others better than yourself. That's what he did. That's what Dad did. So, I want to close with a practical application. I want to give you something to take home with you. And that is three things. You do these three things, and you will have the impact in your life that he had in his life. Number one, recognize the gift that God gave you. He didn't give us all gifts to be coaches. He didn't give me a gift to be coach. But he did give all of us a gift. Whatever that gift is in your life, you use that gift, and God will do mighty things through you. His gift was coaching, and he used that gift to change the world. Number two, get your own rubber stamp. Carry it around with you, that stamp that says valuable. And every time you meet somebody new, you take out that stamp. They won't know what you're doing. Stamp them on the forehead And from that point on, every time you see them, you look at that person and say, you are valuable. You are valuable to God, and therefore, you are valuable to me. Use the gifts God gave you. Consider everyone you meet as valuable. And number three, find a way to share your testimony with them. Find a way to focus on the Lord. That draws out of people a yearning that we all have. We all have this deep desire to be at peace with our God, with our Maker. Find a way to draw it out. That's what he did. Those were the three steps they did in life. Now, having said that, I think it's an appropriate way, an appropriate way to finish the service is to share with you the good news that he shared with so many people. There's so many different ways to share the gospel. You could share it by quoting scripture. You could share it by your personal testimony. You could share it by whatever the facts appear that are in your conversation. But let me once again tell you the simple, simple story that we all need to be reminded of every now and then. Number one, God is holy. God is righteous. God is perfect. In him there is no sin, there is no fault. He created us all. Number two, we as men and women are not perfect. We are sinful. If we think we're perfect, we are just fooling ourselves. Deep inside everybody's heart, we all know that we're sinners. And we all know that there's something wrong, something that needs to be corrected. But God being holy and us being sinful, there's a gap in between that because God cannot be around sin. Sin is abhorrent to God. He wants nothing to do with it. So what do we do? We have a God who is perfect and we who are sinful. What do? We can't do anything. But God did something. He created a way to connect him as a holy God to us as a sinful man. And that is, he sent his son to earth, Jesus. Jesus lived a perfect life. He never did anything wrong his whole life. Despite the fact that he lived a perfect life, he was sent to earth with one purpose, and that was to die so that by his death, by his shed blood, we who are sinful men can be born again, can be made new, can receive Jesus Christ as our Savior, and therefore be made perfect in the eyes of God. The Bible says, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. That's why in the Old Testament, they're sacrificing animals all the time. It was not to forgive the sins. It was to show a picture of what Jesus was going to do when he came to the cross. He was the perfect sacrifice. The animals covered over the sins. Jesus was the perfect covering and the perfect sacrifice for the forgiveness of our sins. It is because of the sacrifice of Jesus that we can be made clean and can be made pure. We have to be involved in this, though. Just because Jesus came and sacrificed, that's not enough. We have to accept Jesus as Lord in our life. We have to make a vow of loyalty and allegiance to Jesus. It's not just enough to know that he died. We have to say, Jesus, I believe you died for me. I know I'm a sinner, and I believe God sent you so that I can be saved. And you have to ask Jesus into your heart and say, would you please come in? Take this mess of a life I've made. I will put you on the throne. You will be Lord of my life, and I will follow you for the rest of my life. However many days, years God gives me, I will follow you. That's what has to happen. When you do that, and then you later die, and you're ushered into the presence of God, God doesn't see Kurt, he doesn't see Jeff, he doesn't see Isaac. He doesn't look at our life, he sees something on our forehead. It says holy. And he sees that holy because he doesn't see us. He sees what Jesus did on the cross, his son who led a perfect life. And that's our ticket. That's how we are justified in the eyes of God. We are justified because we come in clothed in the robe of Jesus Christ. So I got a question for you. Have you experienced that? You may have been in church your whole life, like TJ. You may even be a leader in church. But I think this is a good opportunity for some self-reflection. Have you made that decision in your life where you have said, I want to be on Jesus' team. I want to have holy stamped on my forehead. I don't want to rely on my righteousness. I want to rely on the righteousness of Jesus Christ. If you haven't done that, today is a great day to do it. We're going to have a closing hymn. We don't have many altar calls here at Walnut Grove. But today, if you're just not sure, you just want to make sure, you come on up while we sing the song. Just meet me, and just if you want to just say, I think I'm there, I'm not sure, or I know I'm not there, whatever. I'll have a very brief discussion with you and pray for you, and you can go back to your seat. So just an opportunity. I thought as we closed and thought about the life of Coach Bill Bomar, it would be a good testament to him that we made this opportunity available for anybody who might want to do it. So if you will open your hymn books, it is a patriotic song, but you could still come up and just share with me whatever's on your heart as we sing the song, number 457 in the red hymnals.